Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Point of Insanity Game Studios Geekery in General podcast. I am Al, and today I will be discussing the sometimes controversial topic of religion in role-playing games. The main part of today's show will be the most use for those who are considering writing a game world, and maybe you want to flesh it out a little bit by creating detailed religions. But I hope all listeners will find the topic of creating a fictional religion to be interesting. The reason that I say religion and role-playing games can be controversial is because of a phenomenon in the early 80s known as the Satanic Panic. I'm not going to focus too much on this topic, but it deserves a brief mention because, whether we like to admit it or not, this was an important event in the history of role-playing games. The Satanic Panic was a time when a segment of the American population became captivated with the idea of a vast satanic conspiracy. Various groups claimed that horror movies, heavy metal music, and role-playing games were part of a hidden agenda to indoctrinate youth into the occult. AD&D First Edition was a popular target since it included various demons and devils in the monster manuals. This was a time when the hobby we love was under attack by people who had no understanding of what role-playing games truly were. For example, consider the cover of the First Edition Dungeon Master's Guide. It features a picture of three adventurers fighting a large, red-skinned humanoid. The back of the book identifies the monster as an Ifrit, though to a casual passerby, the monster could easily be misinterpreted as the devil. It's easy to understand why people may have come to incorrect conclusions about role-playing games back then. Remember, this was the early 80s, so RPGs as we know them were still fairly young. Information about role-playing games was a bit harder to come by. Also, sometimes news outlets have a habit of reporting something that they think is true, but later turns out to not be true. And, of course, this is a phenomenon that happens today. Every now and then you might see a friend of yours post a link to an article on Facebook or another social media site claiming that, you know, this is an article with some controversial subject, but, you know, a few days later we find out that the article wasn't true. And that's because, well, sometimes news outlets don't quite do a thorough job of fact-checking. For example, Joe the anchorman might think that Bob the production manager did the fact-checking. Meanwhile, Bob the production manager thinks that Carl the intern did the fact-checking. However, it turns out no one did the fact-checking, and as a result, the news outlet ran a story that turned out to not be true. In many cases, people used outright lies to inspire hostility towards role-playing games. One such anti-D&D activist was named Patricia Pulling. Her son, an avid D&D player, unfortunately committed suicide in 1982. She responded by forming a group called BAD, or Bothered by Dungeons and Dragons. In her words, she described D&D, and I quote, as a fantasy role-playing game which uses demonology, witchcraft, voodoo, murder, rape, blasphemy, suicide, assassination, insanity, sex perversion, homosexuality, prostitution, satanic-type rituals, gambling, barbarism, cannibalism, sadism, desecration, demon summoning, necromatics, divination, and other teachings. Now, I don't know about you, but in all the years I've been playing Dungeons and Dragons, things like that generally don't come up in my game sessions. When they do, the people I've always gamed with have realized that this is a game. We're pretending that we're wizards casting magic spells. We realize that we are not people actually casting magic spells. We know the difference between fantasy and reality, and I'm sure the vast majority of role-playing game players out there do realize that there is a difference between reality, fantasy, and that it is just a game. Well, eventually, the panic subsided, though it has flared up on occasion, like the Harry Potter books are a good example. I remember hearing stories about people who claimed that the Harry Potter books were trying to promote witchcraft and indoctrinate children into witchcraft and wizardry. However, most of the people that I personally know or who have talked to actually felt that the Harry Potter books were very positive. I remember several years ago, my wife dragged me to one of those midnight release parties at the local Barnes & Noble bookstore. I think it was for, I'm wanting to say Order of the Phoenix, but it was one of those big extravaganzas. There were, you know, tons of people there. Everyone was dressed up in costumes, and, you know, they had games and trivia for the children, and you had to wait in a huge line until midnight when they could start selling the books. And I remember I was talking to a gentleman who mentioned that he was a local school teacher, and he liked the Harry Potter books and the effect that they had on some of the children in his class. As he put it, "When was the last time you saw 4th, 5th, and 6th graders willingly pick up a 500 or 600 page book and read it?" Other popular targets for the occasional reflaring of a satanic panic have included Magic the Gathering and even Pokemon. They fell accusation to that they were promoting Satanism in the occult, which, of course, we know that a lot of times these was a result of people who just didn't know what the heck they were talking about. Well, if you would like to learn more about the Satanic Panic, I would like to recommend the March 4th, 2015 episode of Monster Talk, a podcast I listen to. It's called El Diablo, the Satanic Panic and Role-Playing Games. Monster Talk is a podcast produced by Skeptic Magazine, and it examines things like cryptids, UFOs, and supernatural phenomenon from a skeptical point of view. Some of you might remember Josh Hadley, who's been on my show a few times. His show, Lost in the Static, discussed the Satanic Panic for their 200th episode, though I do want to point out that they do use no small amount of profanity on Lost in the Static, so if you are going to listen to that show, please use discretion when determining who you listen to, who's around when you listen to that episode. And what they did on that one is they focused a lot on the whole music and the heavy metal side of it. They had some clips from a show that Geraldo Rivera did where he was discussing the whole Satanic Panic. To move on, I'm lucky because my parents never got into the whole Satanic Panic thing. Then again, though, I really didn't start to really get involved in playing D&D on a regular basis until the late 80s, and by this time, the panic had largely diminished. I think another reason that my parents never really went for the whole Satanic Panic thing is, well, I stayed out of trouble, and I kept my grades at a reasonable level, and the people that I hung out with and played D&D with weren't known to be troublemakers. So I think the way they probably saw it is, look, if I'm going over to a friend's house to play D&D, they know where I am, they know what I'll be doing, they know who I'm going to be hanging around with. I had proved that I could be responsible, so they were willing to give me a good deal of freedom. For the most part, as long as I let them know when I would probably be home, they were cool with me going out to play D&D until 10 or 11 o'clock at night, as long as it wasn't on a school night, but hey, that's another story. Well, on today's topic, creating a fictional religion for use in a role-playing game, or like I said, maybe if there's any aspiring authors out there, if you want to write a novel and maybe want to flesh out the religion, here's some things you can consider. Now, before we get into that, though, I just want to go into a little bit of my background, because I do have a background in religious studies. I became interested in the academic study of religion while I was attending classes at UW Oshkosh. There was a class I took called Exploring Religion, and it gave a brief overview of the five major world religions. It also covered a variety of other topics in religion as well. So it was team taught by a group of three professors. The first was Dr. Edward Linenthal. Now, I didn't really take too many classes with him. I only took one other class with him called Religion in America. And from what I understand, he was a kind of professor that really loved to assign lots of reading. A friend of mine in the religious studies program told me how she took a class called Religion and the Holocaust. And it was known as the Book a Week class because, well, Oshkosh ran 14-week semesters and there were 12 books assigned for this class. And these weren't just little 1 or 200-page books. These were like 3, 4, 500-page books. So yeah, you had to read a book a week in order to keep up with that class. The next professor was Dr. Kathleen Corley. She was primarily a New Testament scholar, and I did take a couple other classes with her. One of my favorite classes I took with her was called Religion and Culture of New Testament Times, and a lot of this class focused on the Gnostics. A good book to read if you're interested in the subject of Gnostics and Gnosticism is the Nag Hammadi Library, because there are certain parallels to what Gnostics believe from that book and some of the things that are in the Bible, in the New and the Old Testament. I also took an advanced study class with her. See, when you got to a certain level at UW Oshkosh, you could take a class called Independent Study, where essentially you met with a professor, you worked one-on-one, and you decided what topic you were going to cover. And with Dr. Corley, I did class that I called Eschatology and Society, where I talked about various end-of-the-world motifs and how some of the beliefs of a society can work into those end-time stories, and I'll be talking more about eschatology later. The third professor in this class was Dr. Wendell Charles Bean. He was one of my favorite professors. He taught a variety of topics, but one of the things that was so interesting about him, he was the kind of professor that sometimes you really had to adjust your way of thinking in order to appreciate him. He could also get very animated during classes. Now, the volume is about to change in just a moment here, so just want to forewarn you. There would be times when Dr. Bean would be talking normally, you know, just normal volume, sounding perfectly normal. But then, all of a sudden, he would get really quiet and very insightful, and it would be almost like he was having a private conversation with God himself. And then the next moment, he would be running around the room, shaking his arms and slamming his fist upon the table. So, like I said, he was just very animated. There were times where he would start out talking very normal and then go really quiet, and then all of a sudden, just boom, out of nowhere, he would go nuts. But he was a really wonderful professor, and I really enjoyed the classes I took with him. One of my favorite classes I did with him was called Myth and Mystery. That was one of those classes that had a bit of a waiting period. It's kind of hard to describe. It talked a lot about different esoteric topics in religion. Also, it covered other things like UFO religions. We also talked a bit about reincarnation, immortality, and there was even a part where we talked a little bit about Atlantis in there as well. So, very interesting class. I also did an independent study project with him called Norse Religion, and he enjoyed that class because he didn't know anything about that topic. So in that case, he said it was a situation where the student became the teacher. So I wrote a 52-page term paper for 2 credits. Yes, I enjoy writing term papers. I am not ashamed to admit that. Well, there's one other professor I'd just like to mention quickly, because I took a lot of his classes. I really enjoyed him. He was a really nice guy, and that was Dr. William Erbrock. And Dr. Erbrock was primarily a New excuse me, he was primarily an Old Testament scholar. So I took classes about, you know, of course, the Old Testament. He did another class called Ancient Near East Religions, which discussed the religion and mythology of ancient Egypt, Babylon, and Cana. There was another one I took where we had an entire class just about the Book of Job. There was another one about Old Testament poetry and prophecy. So, as I said, he was a really fun teacher to work with. And again, I did take another independent study class with him as well, where the one I took with him was the character and development of Satan through the Old Testament. Well, now that I sidetracked enough, let's get on to the topic. Now, there have been many attempts at creating a religion in various role-playing games. In a lot of cases, I'm going to use D&D as an example because it's a game that many people have played. Also, some of the Dungeons & Dragons classes like Cleric and Paladin indicate that religion was probably an important part of life in these fantasy realms. Now, as I recall, basic D&D really didn't get too detailed with the description of a cleric's religious duties. The one that I can remember is, it was the re-release that had the picture by Larry Elmore on the cover of a warrior fighting a dragon in a room full of treasure. And if you remember from my episode I did with my friend Dan from Radio Free Borderlands about the artwork of Dungeons and Dragons, that's one of my favorite pictures I've seen by Larry Elmore and one of my favorite D&D pictures. I believe in that one they said that while they describe a cleric as someone who worships a god or a goddess, however, they said it was not necessary to go into detail as to the specifics of the cleric's religious duties. Now, this version came out in the later 80s, so like mid to late 80s. So I think one of the reasons they did that change in there is because, again, they were trying to appease the people who were accusing Dungeons and Dragons of teaching Satanism or the occult. Now, the first edition D&D, again, they really didn't go too much in the core rulebook. I do recall in the first edition supplement, Deities and Demigods, which would eventually become Legends and Lore, they talked a little bit more about the clerics. I believe there was a table on the back of the book where they mentioned all the deities that were discussed in the book, and they just did things like what type of vestments they wore and, you know, what were the holy times of year for them, if there was a specific totem animal, and so on. Second edition would do more to really flesh out and develop the cleric. In the second edition player's handbook, I know they did give some very brief rules for creating a specific cleric, like a cleric of the god of war, or a god of love, or a god of agriculture. They would take this one step further in the Complete Priest's Handbook, where, again, they describe different religious sects, like, you know, again, clerics of war, clerics of storm, you know, a cleric of the community, and these entries describe the, you know, suggested weapon requirements, as well as what spells they would have access to, and any granted powers. The second edition Legends and Lore really expanded upon this, where they gave more detail for specialty priests. Usually they talked a little bit about the duties, but they also went into the granted powers. I don't know as much about how they really handled the cleric class in 3rd and 4th edition, because I just don't have as much experience with those editions. And I haven't looked too much at the cleric yet in 5th edition. I have played 5th edition a few times, but so far I've only played a ranger character. Now, it's understandable, though, that when you're creating a role-playing game, you're going to focus mostly on the game mechanic stuff, like whether a cleric can use certain types of weapons, whether they can use certain types of armor, what types of spells they might be able to access. Obviously, a cleric of a god of healing is going to have access to healing spells, whereas a cleric of the god of disease probably isn't going to have those spells. Or if he does, he might only be able to use the reverse. For example, cause disease instead of cure disease. But of course, there's a lot more to religion than just what types of armor or weapons a cleric would theoretically use and what type of spells they would theoretically cast. So I'd like to just discuss some of the elements and some of the purposes of a religion. Now first, one of the things that virtually every religion does is it has some sort of creation story. People, we just naturally are curious about where we came from. Did the universe ever have a beginning? Will it eventually have an end? Well, creation stories are, of course, going to cover the first part of did the universe have a beginning? Now, when I was in my exploring religion class, I remember Dr. Bean, he did do a section about creation mythology. And I want to mention that when I'm using the term myth or mythology in this podcast, I'm referring to myth as a sacred story, not as one of the other uses in that something that's not true. I'm using myth to describe sacred stories. So please keep that in mind. But he mentioned that there's four themes that are very common in creation mythology. And sometimes they even use several examples in the same story. One of the examples is the universe being created from a cosmic egg. I don't know any specific examples, but I believe some of the Asian religions use this motif, and I think that some of the Polynesian mythology also has the cosmos coming from a cosmic egg as well. The next example is fertilization of the primordial waters, and this is the idea where life arises from a great primordial ocean, which the myth may or may not explain where it came from. An example of that might be a lot of the ancient Near East religions, like I believe the Egyptian creation story has some elements of the primordial waters, as does the Babylonian stories as well. The next one is dismemberment of the primordial giant. This story involves either a god or a group of gods taking on some great monster, whether it's a giant or, in the case of the Babylonian creation story, in Enuma Elish, it is the chaos dragon Tiamat. And just an important side note, Tiamat, as portrayed in Babylonian mythology, is a lot different than the Tiamat that we're familiar with in Dungeons & Dragons. But when a creation story uses this motif, it's not uncommon for them to describe how this part of the giant became the mountains, and this part of the giant became the rivers, and this part became the sky. Another example I can think of offhand is Norse mythology, where the gods Odin and his brothers Vili and Ve defeat the giant Ymir, and they use his body to create the world. The final example is the universe being willed into existence by a deity. The most well-known example of this is probably in the Old Testament in Genesis. You know, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. So that's an example of the fourth motif. Now, of course, there's other stories that often have, I said, different elements or might not follow those four motifs that I just mentioned. For example, in some Native American tribes, their legends, they call North America Turtle Island. And this particular story was told to me by a friend who, I believe she's Ojibwa, but the story goes that in the beginning, the Great Spirit created the water. And then he created the water beings, which were the fish and the birds. And he could hear the water beings splashing around, but he couldn't see them. So Great Spirit created the light. Well, it was said one of the birds went up to where she thought Great Spirit was and said that they were grateful for the water, but birds were not like fish, that sometimes we need places to build our nests and to rest. So Great Spirit said that he would need someone to get mud for him from the bottom of the ocean. Now, there's different variations, but essentially what happens is the birds dive down as deep as they can to try to get mud. And it starts out with the largest and strongest birds, but in the end, it's the tiny coot who manages to go down and bring up some mud. Well, Great Spirit needed a place to put this mud. So, what he did is he asked someone to let him put the mud on his back, and Grandmother Turtle volunteered. So Great Spirit started to put mud on Grandmother Turtle's back, and eventually he used that to form North America, which is why it's said that her descendants, the turtles, are the only people who are at home under the water, under the earth, with turtles burrowing, of course, and on the land. Another topic to consider is cosmology, the nature of the universe and its structure. So this is usually very closely tied to the creation story. Again, I mentioned how in stories where there's the dismemberment of the primordial giant, usually there's going to be a part in that story that's going to talk about what parts of the giant became which parts of the universe. Some examples, well, in Norse mythology, there's the cosmic world tree, Yggdrasil, of which the Earth, or Midgard, is one single part on that tree. And the Norse legends have a lot of colorful descriptions where they talk about Asgard, Valhalla, the home of the gods, being at the top, and, you know, there's the three Norns at the Well of Fate at the bottom of the tree, and there's a giant dragon that's trying to chew the roots of the tree, and there's a large eagle that stands at the top of the tree keeping watch, and it's said that there's a squirrel, I think the name was like Ratatouille, who goes back and forth between the dragon and the eagle, telling what, you know, one of them is saying about the other. Another interesting example of cosmology is from Gnosticism. And again, I learned about this when I took that Gnosticism class and we were reading the Nag Hammadi Library. Now, the Gnostics weren't exactly very popular. They were branded as heretics and often persecuted. You see, the Gnostics believed that the God of the Bible was not the true God. They believed that the God in the Bible was actually a demiurge named Ildabaoth, who took fragments of light from what they call the true father or the living father, took those fragments of light and trapped them in the material world. Well, and said there's also seven heavens, but these are not the seven heavens we know of in Dungeons and Dragons. Rather, each of these heavens is guarded by a being known as an Archon. Again, not the same Archons that we know from Dungeons and Dragons. Well, it's said that when the soul dies, he has to go to one of these gates, and the Archon is going to ask him a question. If the person answers the question correctly, he moves on to the next gate. If he doesn't answer the question correctly, then he's sent back to Earth because, again, he's trapped in the material world to suffer. Well, next there's the topic of moral teachings. Every religion is going to have a list of do's and don'ts. These are things that the practitioner of that faith needs to do to live what they consider a moral, righteous life. And something that's actually very closely tied to that is, what is the nature of evil? Where did evil come from? And that's a question that's answered in a lot of religions. For example, in the Bible, there's the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. Another example is, of course, from Greek mythology, Pandora's box, explaining how the Greeks thought that evil came into the world. As I mentioned, moral teachings are another important aspect of religion. And, of course, we know things like the Ten Commandments are an example. Another example would be in Buddhism, there are the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are that suffering exists, the cause of suffering is desire, suffering can be ended, and that the way to end suffering is to follow the Eightfold Path, which includes things like, you know, the right effort and the right mindset and the right livelihood. The nature of evil, of course, is always a very interesting part of religion as well. one example I can think of off the top of my head is from the book of Job. Now, a lot of times in religions, they often picture the cause or the root of evil as being some sort of dark entity, like a Satan or a devil figure. Whereas in the book of Job, in this case, Satan actually acts quite differently. And I'm not going to get too specific, but there are scholars that believe that the Satan that is mentioned in the book of Job is not the Satan that people think of. It has to do with the pronunciation. It's like the... Now, I don't speak Hebrew, so I may be mispronouncing this, but there was a difference between Hasatan and Hasatan. And I remember Dr. Erbrock mentioning this, where one of them referred to a specific person, a being, where the other was a title, the Satan, and in this case, the Satan being an accuser. And the way it works in the book of Job is the Satan says to God that, well, here's, you know, Job, and do you think that if you took away all his, you know, his wealth and his prosperity, do you think he would still be this perfect, righteous servant that you think he is? And in this particular case, God grants the Satan permission to cause all sorts of tragedies to befall Job. And in the end, Job gets everything restored because he keeps his faith and he doesn't do what the Satan thought he was going to do. He doesn't curse God. Instead, he kind of accepts his fate. Another aspect of religion, which can be good or bad, is worldview. And how do they react towards people of other religions or people of no religion at all? For example, do they see people who follow other religions as people who are being deceived? Do they see them as souls that need to be saved through conversion? Or do they see them as infidels that need to be conquered and slain? It's also possible that members of a certain religion might think, well, as long as you leave me alone and you don't do any harm towards me or anyone else, then I really don't care what religion you follow. Now, it's important to note that members of a religion don't necessarily have to hate members of other religions, even if they think those other religions are wrong. One example I can remember from my religious studies classes, it was the class on world religions I took. In the unit on Hinduism, the host, Bill Moyers, was, I'm pretty sure it was Bill Moyers anyway, he was interviewing a Hindu woman. And he was saying that, well, do you think that me as a Christian, that I'm on the wrong path? And the Hindu woman said, yes, but don't worry, you'll get it right eventually. And the woman wasn't trying to be rude. See, she believed that Hinduism was the correct religion. However, the reason she didn't feel the need to go out and convert people is because Hinduism believes in reincarnation, which we'll get to in just a moment. But essentially what it means is that they believe that once, well, when you're born into a certain caste. And what you have to do is you have to be a good member of that caste, you know, that social level. And if you are a good member of that particular social group, let's say, for example, you are born into the warrior caste, well, you have to be a good warrior. And if you're a good warrior, you earn good karma. And then when you die, your soul is reincarnated in the next caste up, which is the priestly caste. So this is what she meant when she said, don't worry, you'll get it right eventually. In a way that, well, a good way to understand Hinduism is it's kind of like the old board game Chutes and Ladders, where sometimes you move up and sometimes you slide back down. So, and that's a result of good or bad karma that you've earned. So again, like I said, if you were born into a warrior caste, you had to be a good warrior in order to move up into the next caste. However, if you were not a good warrior, then you would move down to the, in your next life anyway, you would move down to the lower caste. So theoretically, they believe that it could take hundreds or thousands of years for the soul to be reunited with Brahman, the ultimate reality. Buddhism has somewhat of a similar belief, though one of the main differences between Hinduism and Buddhism is Buddhists believe that it is possible to work through all your bad karma in a single lifetime. Well, this brings us to the topic of afterlife. You know, again, as I mentioned with Hinduism and Buddhism, they believe in reincarnation, that it's possible to come back after you die. However, death in some religions is actually more permanent. For example, the belief in Christianity of a heaven and a hell, where if you did good things during your life, you would go to heaven. And then if you did bad things, of course, you would go to hell. Now, this, of course, brings up the question of, well, where do people who don't believe in my religion go? Again, that's going to depend on who you're going to ask. I know that there have been some people that have said that, well, if you're a good person, even if you don't follow my religion, you know, you don't follow my religion, then you can still go to heaven. Now, another example is where you don't necessarily go to a bad place when you die, but if you fail to lead an exceptional life, then you're not necessarily going to have a glorious afterlife. Good example is in Norse mythology, where, of course, the people who died bravely and who died in battle went to Valhalla, whereas the people who didn't quite live a glorious life would go to Hel, spelled H-E-L. And it wasn't necessarily pictured as a bad place. It was more just kind of a bleak, gray place. If I'm not mistaken, I believe the ancient Greeks had a similar belief where, you know, after you died, you went to Hades, but there was a certain part of Hades that was set aside for the great heroes, whereas people who, you know, were, of course, people who were bad were punished. I remember several stories about people who experienced different punishments in Hades. I can't remember the guy's name, but he had to stand in a river, and there was a branch above him with fruit. Whenever he tried to reach up to get the fruit, the branch would move out of his reach. Whenever he tried to bend down to get a drink of water, then the water level would sink so that he couldn't drink water. And there was another one where he was forced to push a boulder up a hill. And I guess he was told that he would no longer suffer if he was able to, you know, get that boulder up to the top of the hill. But of course, every time he was almost to the top, the boulder would roll back and crush him, and he'd have to go back down and start over again. Well, another thing to consider when designing a religion is the end of the world. Because as they say, all good things must come to an end. Good example, the Bible, there is the Book of Revelations where it talks about an end-of-days scenario. And there, the Norse also had a belief with Ragnarok, where it was believed that there would be this final battle where the gods would die, but their children would survive, and they would go on to inherit a perfect, peaceful world. And actually, one thing that is kind of interesting, and I do have my copy of the Poetic Edda right by. For those of you who might have a copy of this book and want to follow along, there's the Seersrus prophecy at the start of the book, and it involves the god Odin talking to the spirit of a prophetess, and he asks for many things. And at the end of the poem, the last verse goes, and this is after the prophetess describes Ragnarok, there's a verse that goes, "There comes from the dark dragon flying, the shining serpent up from the dark of moon hills. Nidhogg flies over the plain in his wings. He carries corpses, now she must sink down." This is from the Carolyn Larrington translation, and that's one of those verses that scholars of Scandinavian studies have often debated where, okay, we see the dragon Nidhogg carrying corpses. Again, Nidhogg's the dragon that chews on the roots of the tree. Does this mean that the vision has ended and Odin has returned to the present? Or does it mean that there will be evil in what is supposed to be this new, reborn, perfect world? Of course, sometimes it is possible for people to take an active role in preventing the end of the world. this is another Native American legend, again, that my friend who was who's Ojibwa told me. And a lot of Native American tribes hold the eagle as being sacred. Now, the story goes that long ago, the Great Spirit, after creating the world, created the people. And he noticed that people were doing good things, but then he started noticing people were starting to do more and more bad things. So the Great Spirit decided that he was going to destroy the world. Well, on the morning that the Great Spirit was going to cause the world to be destroyed, the eagle flew out of his nest and flew up to where the Great Spirit was and told him that, you know, no, you can't destroy the world, because even though there are wicked people doing bad things, there's still good people doing good things. So it was said that the Great Spirit made a deal with the eagle that, you know, every morning you have to report back to me and tell me about the fact that there are still people doing good things, which is why they was believed it was important to do good deeds, because it meant that the eagle could tell the Great Spirit that there are still people on the world who are trying to accomplish good in the middle of wickedness. So just another little interesting story that I've picked up over the years. Well, let's get on to a cheerier topic, because, of course, the end of the world usually is not seen as a very pleasant thing to think about. Holidays. This is another important thing to think about when creating a religion. Now, in a lot of ancient pagan religions, usually the solar festivals were the most important. The summer and winter solstices and the autumn and spring equinoxes. The equinoxes being when day and light were about the same amount of time, and the solstices being, well, when during the summer solstice when we had the longest day of the year, and the winter solstice when we had the longest night of the year. Now, in the case of the winter solstice, one of the reasons that it was seen as being important is because this was the, of course, when it was starting to get really, really cold, and the sun was lowest in the sky. And some people believe that, or in some cultures, rather, they believe that it meant the world was, or the sun was going to be dying. So what they needed to do was perform whatever ceremonies to coax the sun back to life. And of course, after the winter solstice, the days slowly start getting longer. So that was signs that it had worked. So those are usually very important. Along the same line as the winter solstice, New Year's. Some religions have very spirited, festive New Year's festivals because the world has made it through one more year, probably without being destroyed by some wrathful deity. Harvest festivals are another important festival, especially in temperate climates where there are four seasons and where you can't grow food all throughout the year. So this might be a time when, of course, farmers are bringing in their last crops, and a lot of the rituals for a harvest festival, generally a combination of two things. A lot of times there's the part where you're thinking about, well, you're giving thanks for your abundant crops that you had, and you're also praying for protection to get you through the coming winter. Another type of holiday that you might consider when creating a fictional religion are festivals commemorating heroes or saints. For example, maybe in your game world there is a story about a hero who drove all the dragons away, or a hero who accomplished many great, seemingly impossible deeds. You might choose to make a festival commemorating that hero. And various rituals could certainly take place. For example, if, let's say you've got, well, the aforementioned example of a hero who drove all the dragons away. Well, the people who follow this religion, they might make a ceremonial hunt where they go out and either look for real dragons, if they still exist, or they might have a mock dragon set up where they, again, have this sacred drama where an actor portraying the hero fights an actor portraying the dragon. Many religions also have certain rituals you can consider. A lot of times rituals will commemorate certain events in life. Probably the most common ones are wedding rituals Usually, if once a child is born, there's going to be some sort of baptism, or and then eventually some sort of coming of age ritual, and then of course death rituals, funeral practices. Those are other things you can consider when creating a fictional religion. And in a way, a lot of it's we can also kind of think of real life, how even today we still have certain things that are considered a rite of passage, such as, well, when you graduate elementary school and go into middle school or high school, when you pass your driver's test, when you, well, some people, when you go on your first date and have your first kiss, that's almost kind of like a rite of passage as well. So this whole idea of rituals and rite of passage, it does change with the times, I guess you could say. Another thing you can do with rituals in a fantasy world is come up with some creative coming of age rituals. For example, the youth of a tribe, when they're coming of age, they might have to spend a few days in the wilderness working together. So that might be actually be an interesting way to start a campaign where all your characters may you're at that age where you're about to become an adult, and your task is you have to go out and survive in the wilderness for a week. Or maybe there's a certain type of monster, like a maybe a manticore or a minotaur or a chimera that the youth in the tribe have to somehow cooperate and defeat. Well, once you've fleshed out the details of the religion, then you can start creating the details of the priesthood, what would roughly be a cleric class. One of the things you always want to consider are the duties. What are the day-to-day things that members of this clergy do? For example, someone who worships a god or goddess of agriculture, part of their duties might be to go out and maybe bless the farming equipment, or keep watch, or bless the fields. Another thing to consider are clothing and vestments. What type of ritual garb do they wear? Do they wear a certain type of cloak? For example, let's say that you decide that the clerics of the God of War in your game world, that they wear a blood-red cloak with black trim. So you could say that the players in this game world, they realize that if they see someone wearing that specific cloak, it means they're a cleric of the God of War, and you probably don't want to mess around with them. You could even make it so that it's actually considered an insult to wear that cloak if you're not a cleric of the God of War, just as an example. Other things to consider are lifestyle restrictions. For example, can they drink alcohol? Are they allowed to get married? Are they allowed to have children if they get married? Do they need to avoid certain foods? Or maybe they can only eat certain types of foods. Maybe you might say that they have to eat a certain type of meat at least once a week, just as an example. Last topic is one that has been covered in just about every fantasy game I've seen where there's a cleric class, and that is weapon and armor usage. Now, usually you want to have some sort of reason as to why the clerics of a particular religion can only use certain types of armor or weapons. The way I always saw it, just as an example, usually clerics of a nature god or goddess, like a druid, they're only allowed to use like leather, bone, or wood armor and shields because those were made of things that were once living. So they were considered more natural than a suit of plate mail. Same thing with weapons. Usually, if the god has a weapon associated with it, then the clerics of that deity might be required to learn, or maybe they can only exclusively use that type of weapon. Again, let's look at Norse mythology. Thor, he has his hammer. So it would certainly make sense that a cleric of Thor, or a cleric of a deity whose weapon is the hammer, needs to learn how to use at least one type of hammer. You could also give him some sort of special bonus with that hammer, whether it's an attack bonus, a damage bonus, or maybe extra experience points if he uses that specific hammer to kill a certain type of monster. There is one game system where they actually had a very interesting take on determining what types of weapon and armor that a cleric could use. And that was TSR's Dark Sun campaign setting. Now, I don't know if they did this in the most recent version of Dark Sun, but I remember from the second edition version of Dark Sun, if you were a cleric, you had to choose to either be a Templar, which was a cleric who worshipped one of the Dragon Kings, or you could be an elemental cleric of earth, air, wind, or fire. And that would determine what type of weapons and armor you could use, and it actually made sense. For example, clerics of air, I don't remember what type of armor they could wear, but for their weapons, they could only use weapons that could be thrown, or they were limited to missile weapons like bows. And I believe clerics of water, they could only use weapons that were and armor that were once made of living things. Again, bone or wood. Clerics of fire, they could use, and I believe clerics of earth as well, clerics of fire could only use metal weapons and armor, and I believe clerics of earth were limited to either metal or stone weapons, and I think the same thing for armor. It's been a while since I've read it, so I don't remember the exact details, but I just thought that was an interesting take on determining what weapons and armor the members of a certain priesthood could use. Well, this will end this topic. I hope you enjoyed it. And again, the academic study of religion is something that's actually very fascinating. So it's something that I do encourage you to do every now and then, even if it's not for the purposes of creating a fictional religion for your game. It is still interesting just to try to look at different religions and see where they're similar and where they're different. Well, I think I'm done getting philosophical and religious for now. Like I said, I hope you weren't bored during this episode. I hope you found some of what I had to say interesting. Maybe you learned a thing or two. I hope so. I just hope you liked the show today. So with that said, if you do have ideas for topics you'd like to see me cover in a future episode, feel free to contact me. You can go to poigamestudio.com and fill out the form on my Contact Me section. Or, what probably be a little easier, go to Facebook. Look up Point of Insanity Game Studio. Stop by the Facebook page. Leave a comment. And please feel free to like the page while you're there. I certainly do appreciate it. Now, I have been doing a lot of video game episodes, so if you're interested in seeing the video game footage for some of my episodes, go to YouTube and look up Point of Insanity Game Studio. Please subscribe. I do appreciate that. Well, thanks again for listening. Have a good evening, or morning, or afternoon, whatever it is, wherever you are, and happy gaming.